The Triathlon Show 332. Up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Jody Swallow Kunema. Jody is a triathlon coach and retired professional triathlete. As an athlete, she went to the Olympics in Athens in 2004, and she has three world championship titles to her name, including one 71.3 world title and two ITU long distance title. As a coach, Jody now coaches a mix of amateur and professional athletes, including, for example, Jody Stimson on the professional side. We'll get right into the interview after thanking our sponsors. First, we have Precision Fuel and Hydration that have a range of tools and products that you can use to help personalize your fueling and hydration strategy so that you can perform at your best. There are some new and exciting products that I want to talk about today. First, there's the Precision Fuel 90 gel, which is affectionately known as the Jumbo Gel. It has 90 grams of carbohydrate, as the name implies, and it has a resealable cap. So this is a great product for carrying efficiency, because even one or a couple of these big gels go a pretty long way, even for a long workout. The other new product is the PF30 Chew, which, as the name suggests, is a chew, where each package contains 30 grams of carbohydrates. And you can get it either in the original flavor, which is a mild and neutral one, or in a mint and lemon flavor. These chews are great options and alternatives to gels or sports drinks, especially during longer workouts at slightly lower intensities, as they can feel a bit more satiating and satisfying than gels and sports drinks. Each chew package, as I said, contains 30 grams of carbohydrate, because as always with Precision Fuel products, one of the main objectives is that it should be easy for you to hit your target numbers. So all products are 30 grams of carbohydrate or multiples of 30 grams. As a listener of the show, you can get 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products by using the code TTS22 at checkout on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Roka. When Roka got started in 2011, the challenge they set out to solve was to create the world's fastest wetsuit. The result of that, in its current iteration, is the Maverick X2, which is the Roka's flagship wetsuit model. 10 years later, in 2021, they set themselves a different challenge, which was to take the extremely high standards of their wetsuits and the key features of the Maverick X2 and create a very budget-friendly wetsuit that doesn't compromise those standards and incorporates as much as possible of the key features of the flagship models. The result of that is the Roka Maverick wetsuit. At $275, it is an entry-level option price-wise, but in terms of quality, it does not play in the entry-level leagues. It has top-quality engineering, design, and materials, classic Roka features such as arms-up technology, patented center-line buoyancy for a better and snappier rotation, Yanomoto neoprene, quick-release ankles, and more. You can read all about the wetsuit on roka.com and visit roka.com/TTS for 20% off your entire Roka order. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Jody Swallow Kunema. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, Jody. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Just enjoying the sunshine in the winter in Britain, which is very rare.
Yeah, well, the spring is approaching, so hopefully you don't have to endure winter too much longer. Can you, for those listeners that might not be familiar with you, introduce yourself and tell us a bit more about yourself and your background?
I am Jody Swallow. I have been around in the world of triathlon since the year 2000, where I was a bit of a precocious junior in the British triathlon system. I stuck with ITU till about the Beijing Olympics. I went to Athens, was deemed before that in pre-selection to be quite a talent, and then I got injured and it all was a disaster. So the 4 years after that, I had personal problems and it just didn't work out. Was on the realms of quitting triathlon, and then on a personal email from a good friend, actually Annie Emerson, who's still in triathlon, I just went on a tip and I emailed Brett Sutton. And from that point, in 2010, I took on long distance triathlon. I won some world titles. And by 2014, I was probably one of the best 70.3 athletes in the world for a couple of years, until I fell pregnant in 2017, having married my long-term partner, James Cunnamer, also a pro triathlete. And we had some babies. We've got three under four now. And I went into coaching. I have been coaching since sort of 2015, but I got more serious when I definitely retired after having my twins a couple of years ago. So now I coach a number of age group and pro triathletes, predominantly online with some physical meetups occasionally. And I'm looking to kind of expand that and develop a elite squad in the coming years down here in Bath.
Yeah. Yeah. And the world titles you mentioned, I think you have two ITU long distance world titles and you have one Ironman 73 world title. Did I get that right?
Yeah, you did. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And what, and Kona, I think you've been fourth, or was that right? I think I should have asked right.
No, I was fourth in 2014 in Kona. Yeah, my best shot. It wasn't really a race built for me. But I think that was my best result I could have got on the day and possibly in a career at the time. Now as a coach, I look back and think, oh, yeah, definitely you could have gone better. But at the time, it was a pretty ideal year for me. And, Kona's a different race. And, you know, it suits some people and it doesn't suit others. But we did the best we could.
Yeah. Well, let's get into coaching, because that's what this podcast is about. Not so much the athletic stories, but the training and the education and the coaching. So can you just give us an overview of what your coaching methodology is like?
Yeah, this is a question that I've come back to time and time again in the past kind of year. When before that, I just coached intuitively, and I didn't really have a word to describe it. It's a very individual approach. None of my athletes have the same program and it varies day to day. So I respond to each day with all my athletes, my age group athletes and my elite athletes to prescribe the next day. I am quite intuitive, right? I base everything on science. I understand the science. I've got a sports science degree. But I also create personal relationships with my athletes and enjoy putting through the art of coaching beside that. So the board base is scientific, the program's based on science, but the adaptions are based on conversations and communication and feedback.
Yeah, got it. And since you have been in ITU and then you went to long distance, and I think you were from a swimming background before your triathlon days as well, you've had a bunch of coaches through your career. And can you talk a little bit about your biggest coaching influences? And are there any examples that you can think of things that you've introduced in your coaching based on things that you found from the coaches that you had yourself, that, hey, this is a smart thing to do, or this is a really good methodology?
Yeah, I think I've had a variety of coaches and they've all been good in different ways. I don't think I've ever had like a really bad coach, because I would have moved on. In my early career as a junior swimmer and runner, my running coach was incredibly basic, incredibly kind, and incredibly intuitive. I think that I've taken that through, and I'd probably say he was, maybe not knowledge-wise, but he was the best coach I've ever had in terms of motivation and keeping me in the sport. And then my swim coaches were always quite like dictators, just kind of prescriptive, and that worked really well for someone that was all over the place in school. I never stopped. I was just constantly being coached or at school. So yeah, that worked really well in some circumstances. And then when I moved into triathlon, my coaches varied greatly. I was coached by my husband James Cunnamer, by Cyril Linley and by Brett Sutton, and those people are incredibly different people, and they have very different approaches to coaching. But Siri, I would definitely say, was an incredible psychological coach in terms of motivational. Sometimes that had its flaws for me personally, but her positive outlook. She's actually gone into motivational speaking now. So that kind of positive outlook, always getting positives from negatives, is something that I definitely draw on occasionally when athletes are going through difficult times. And then Brett Sutton, he's a funny man, and I'm I still remain in contact with him and quiz him a few times, maybe a few times a month. But I think with Brett, I learned that athletes are physical specimens, and you can learn quite a lot from the way they talk to you, the way they communicate, and their body language. And whilst I'm not physically with athletes at the moment, I can actually pick that up on Training Peaks as well, in terms of feedback, in terms of silence on WhatsApp and things like that. So looking at athletes' behavior as opposed to their physical numbers often gives you another dimension in terms of their data. So that's what I've learned from that. And I think that's probably something I work on quite heavily. And it's a real talent that I'm trying to develop.
Yeah, no, those are great examples. And you mentioned there that now as a coach, you have some ideas of what you maybe could have done differently as an athlete as well. Can you give an example of that, or a couple of examples if you have some that come to mind?
Yeah, I think when you're an athlete, you think that you've got the world on your shoulders and that you're on a time limit and that everything is so important in terms of the bigger context. But as a coach, when I look at my athletes, sometimes I want to wring them by the necks because they have time. You don't need to move up the rankings as quickly as you think you do. You can work on things slowly and progressively and get there in a few years. I think it's probably influenced quite heavily with there's not that much money in pro triathlon. And that when their money comes in, I think people want to rush to that money and prove themselves, and they're quite... they're not externally motivated, but they want to succeed, and the money you win reflects that success, I think, in long distance triathlon. So I just wish that they would have more patience. And I know that if I'd had more patience, I wouldn't have been injured as much. I would have been calmer during and after races, and I probably would have planned a little bit better. To the projects that I undertook and how the seasons and years evolved. I'd keep the passion, but I would take out some of the emotion that athletes feel. And I try to keep everyone a bit more zen than I was.
Yeah, that's a good answer. And increasing the amount of patience, or understanding of just how much patience it takes to be great, but also have longevity in the sport. And one thing, then, you mentioned you coach both professional and age group athletes. How does that compare? What are the key similarities and differences between those two groups?
They are quite different, age groupers and professionals. And I definitely feel more affinity to coaching professionals because the absolute necessity to get it right is there. You know, their livelihoods depend on the training that you're giving them and how they're executing it. So there's definitely more precision that needs to be done, more feedback, and they have more time to do it. A lot of age groupers that I coach have families, they have full-time jobs, and when you're putting training into a couple of hours or 1 hour a day even, then you need to make that hour or 2 hours count and then move on. There's no coming back to it. You just have to move on, do the best you can in the session and move on. And I, with the age groupers, I tolerate a lot of adaption because of life, because although triathlon is very important to those people, it doesn't dictate them. And I think that's the difference with a professional triathlete and an age group triathlete. Age group triathletes are doing it for various motivations, but should primarily be to enhance their life, their family life, their work life, their health. And professional athletes are doing it to be the absolute best that they can be. and will sacrifice and should perhaps sacrifice a lot more.
Other than a difference in big difference in training volume, does that can you see those differences in the type of training that you prescribe for age groupers versus professionals?
Yeah, definitely. The professionals have a much broader base in terms of aerobic time they spend because they have a lot more time to do that training. And although I try and keep the predominant feature of age group sessions, especially in sort of the base period where we're not building up to a race, it's got to be predominantly aerobic, but it also has to concentrate on technique, maintaining FTP, some speed session, and then you've got the three sports as well. So it's quite a difficult task, actually, to each individual. I always focus on the things that are going to make the biggest difference in age group triathlon, which the athletes that I coach are predominantly doing Ironman and 70.3. So that would be cycling and running, having cycled. So swimming in the professional ranks is a very important aspect of triathlon, because if you are not in the frame after the swim, it's very difficult to become in the frame. Whereas age group triathletes maybe don't have the time to create a bigger proportion of advantage from the swim. So I focus far less on the swim, and they might only swim a couple of times a week if they've only got 7 hours to train, because just to maintain some swimming fitness, but I can't coach them properly at swimming because there's too much else to do.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. When you take on a new athlete, what are the first things that that you do?
I always have an interview. As we're talking now, I will video call them and get a vibe of where they're coming from, their lives, their backgrounds, their motivations, and then I decide if we'd work very well together or we wouldn't, and they do too. Then I ask them a little bit about what training they're doing at the moment, what they've done in the past, and I'll set a couple of very easy aerobic weeks, and then I'll monitor the data on training peaks so that I can start to identify areas that we can work on quickly and effectively. And then we go from there. It's a very kind of organic process. I don't always set fitness tests, although sometimes I'm coming into that area because there's a real kind of push at the moment in terms of age group coaching. That's it's become very fashionable to know your FTP. Well, possibly because of the pandemic, because people have been stuck on turbos and on Zwift, and they can see their powers going up and down, etc. So I adopt that a little bit, but I adopt it depending on how the athlete likes it, to be honest. Because with the trends that I've seen in coaching is that it's very much roundabouts where I'm at anyway. If you want a figure to quantify it, that's absolutely fine. But that's the areas that I'm working on anyway. So it depends if they're statistical people or if they're just feel people. And that kind of is influenced quite a lot with gender, I think.
Yeah, yeah, that I agree with that. And line of work and so on. There's definitely a demographic where there is a desire to have all of the quantitative data that you can. And sometimes that's fine, like to do something, even if you wouldn't do it otherwise, just because the athlete gets motivated by it.
Yeah.
Have you observed any trends in what you would typically change compared to how athletes have been training before? Are there some things that keep coming up that I always end up doing these sorts of changes? Athletes always do this and that, and I kind of go about changing it when I get to know them.
Yeah, a little. I mean, some of them are coming to me from a break, so not so much. So I don't have the record of what they were doing before. So it's almost like a new start for them, and they don't really tell me too much about what their old coaches do, etc. And I don't ask because I don't really want to be heavily influenced by what they've done. I just want to do what I do. But I think they tend to neglect regular, consistent blocks of training. So it will be like 3 weeks of passion and 2 weeks off, and then 3 weeks hard again, and then a 2 week break, and then a camp. And I think that the thing that I really want to get across to age groups, athletes, it's quite a lot about consistency and just getting out there a lot of the time. Even if it's half of the session that was prescribed, as long as you start to get out there, then usually the momentum can carry on. And it is about momentum when you're preparing for a long race, consistency and momentum. So that's something that I see that I try and influence.
Yeah. What about on the professional side? I guess there might not be as many trends there because you probably don't have to convince them about consistency. That's probably fairly well established.
Yeah, I think it depends on the professional that you're coaching. I coach Jodie Simpson, who's come from an ITU background and is going to long distance. So there's obviously some obvious changes that in terms of volume, in terms of bike volume that I'm bringing in with her, but and in terms of the importance of bike output as well, because you can't fudge it in the longer distances, the bike, whereas in ITU sometimes you can get away with a little bit of neglect on the bike. But I think, no, they have absolute passion in trying to get better, and it's just directing that passion in the right areas and trying to nail down what actually improves you, which is rest and recovery. And it's easy to pile on work upon work upon work, but it's not really about that. It's about maintaining a level where you can maintain that level and not get stale and not get overtrained and get to a race and produce the goods. If you break down before the race, there's no point in any of it. So I think there's quite a lot of pulling the reins in my professional athletes, the ones that I have at the moment anyway. And yeah, I quite enjoy that because that was the type of athlete I was too. I'm sure one day I'll get someone that doesn't want to do it as much as I did. And that'll be interesting.
Yeah. So what that's an interesting point that you make there. And how specifically do you function in recovery make sure that you get the balance right between recovering and training in this example with the professional athletes?
They're on different periodization sort of cycles. So the girls are predominantly longer. They'll do like a 4 week block and a week easier. And they'll be begging for their easier block. And then when the easier block comes, they'll be asking for more training. So it's just managing that that kind of mix of like messages that you're getting, because as soon as you give an athlete rest, they want to train, just in the normal psychology of things. So that's what I deal with Jodie in particular. The men do 3 weeks harder and 1 week easier, just because through experience and through people that I've coached, James certainly couldn't sustain the longer blocks as well as I could. So it's just developmental from that, but it was always changing depending on the athlete and depending on the strengths. And then I've got one pro athlete that likes to quiz me about scientific methods and scientific and the latest data and the latest podcast and the latest trend in coaching. And yeah, it means I have to do some research to answer his questions and make sure that he's taking his rest that I'm giving him, whereas he's not like following some podcast that says that he should be doing more.
Yeah, that's a tricky one that I have with like doing a podcast. That sometimes, you know, there is an expectation that as a coach, I'm supposed to implement everything that everybody says on the podcast. But then you have basically a potluck of advice that doesn't necessarily go well together. So
yeah,
so you still have to, no matter all, even if you listen to and read all the information that's out there, you still have to make a lot of simplifications and put together your own methodology that works coherently as a model.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you listen to anything, if you listened to a speech by Putin at the moment, there would be one thing in there that you kind of understand and agree with, even though you hate everything that he's done, doing. So any podcast that you listen to, or any book that you read, or any research that you do, there's going to be one point in there that relates to you and that you understand and that you could implement. It's the choice of whether you choose to implement that or not. And that's the judgment call, and that's the coach's job.
Yeah. And then it's also important to consider the opportunity cost. If you implement something, does that mean that you don't implement something else, or that you push something else away? And what is the most beneficial at the end of the day? So, yeah, it's easy to get excited about things you hear and read, but it's important to have practice a bit of restraint, I guess.
Yeah, it's restraint.
Really think about things.
Yeah, and keep it in perspective, in terms of the bigger picture.
Yeah. Okay. So then let's see, where were we? Okay. So I'm going to ask you to give some advice about the different disciplines and how to improve swimming, biking, and running. And for this example, let's take age group athletes for training for half and full distance races as the context. So first of all, if you want to start with swim training, can you give 1 to 2 pieces of advice for that?
Swim training, don't neglect technique. So especially age groupers, if your technique is bad, if you can't catch the water properly, it will cause you to not improve as much as any fitness training will. So you need to get that right. You need to speak to someone that knows what they're doing, that can help you catch the water properly. And that is quite a difficult task in itself, because there's a lot of people that will give you advice and not all of it is right. So you have to pick your person.
Yeah. What about the bike?
Cycling, I would cycle with other people. I think that cycling outside in groups maintains a good aerobic base usually, and it's a long time to spend on your own if you don't have company, I think. And so I would always say enjoy the safety of others and learn from them and ask questions of them and try and create a little training squad so that those miles on the bike are not as lonely and helps you get out in the cold and the wet as well.
And the run?
Running, I would change my tact a little bit. I would say that it's not all about same pace running. It's not just about steady runs. I would start to implement some harder stuff, even if it's just 2 minute blocks at threshold. Start with 5 of them, and then, you know, each week do another one, and then eventually you will see your running improving. I think that sometimes it's really easy to stay static on the run by just running steady, and I've seen that a lot in the age group as I coach. They just didn't do run sets.
So all of these pieces of advice can obviously also be turned on their head, and that's kind of a potential mistake, like not doing run sets, for example. But do you have any other things that you would say that, like, these are some mistakes to avoid, or things that you see that hold people back?
Mistakes to avoid on the run.
In general, this across swim, bike, and run.
Mistakes to avoid in general, I would say, across the triathlon program would be that you're doing a triathlon program. You're not a swimmer, you're not a cyclist, and you're not a runner. You're a triathlete, and therefore the sessions have to correspond to each other. You have to have a program that incorporates the effort that you've put into the other disciplines in that week. So you're not trying to – it's just so different to doing a run program or a marathon program or a half marathon program, because that run isn't going to be the same if you've had to cycle 3 hours the day before. So it would be about triathlon and about triathlon specificity rather than the single disciplines in terms of balance and intensity output across them.
Yeah, that makes sense. And let's talk a bit about racing. Can you discuss some most important things that athletes should do and not do when they're preparing for their race, like, or in the final kind of not training but race preparation or race execution itself?
Is this for professionals or age groupers?
Well, we can take both. Why don't you start with professionals?
Okay, professional. So professionals race for a living. So usually they're quite good at racing, which is why they're still professionals. But I think what's important in terms of a big goal lead up is that you don't change too much in the lead up to it and put yourself vulnerable in terms of injury so that you actually get to the start line in one piece and get to show off the work that you've done. And understand that it's a performance in terms of showing everyone else your work. It's not a pressured situation. No one else really cares. It's actually just about you and about showing off every single minute of training that you've done and enjoying it. I think that the only thing that would make a professional athlete not perform if they've done the work is pressure. And I think that with professional triathlon, you are trying to earn money and you might be short of money or you might have been injured. So you put more pressure on yourself, and that sometimes means that you begin to make silly little mistakes in preparation for races. You forget the things that are really important, like knowing the course, like knowing transition, like preparing your nutrition plan, and it all gets covered up by what she said in the press conference or how fit she looked or if he's trying to wind you up or this or that. And actually, it's quite a simple process. It's just a performance. And if you're prepared, you should be able to execute quite easily if you don't let your head get in the way. And for age groupers,
one question on the professionals there. What do you think is the balance between having your own race plan and also being able to respond and responding to the race dynamics and what's going on around you, what the others are doing?
Yeah, I think race plans always, in my experience, don't work. So you think you're going to know what someone's going to do, and then that doesn't happen, and then someone else does something else, and they always fall by the wayside, and you end up making decisions on the spot in the minute that influence the race. But that's racing, and that's the excitement of it. I think if you prepare yourself to make the right decision in that minute of every minute, you make the right decision at that time and respond. Then if it's the wrong decision, the next minute is another minute and you make a different decision. So do the best you can in the moment and then respond the next time and don't hang on to it. That's what I would say in terms of race plans. It's good to have a general idea about how the swim might pan out, who's a good swimmer in the race, where you should be around, but it's not in cement because all the factors that are affecting you in terms of nerves, in terms of injury, in terms of preparation affect every single other person in the field. And so I'm not a mathematician, but that would be quite a lot of variables if you multiply them all. So yeah, then it's never going to fall directly into place, but you just do the best that you can and have a plan in the back of your head and follow it to the amount that you can and then adapt.
Yep. All right. And what about the age groupers?
Age group is slightly different because you're not reacting to other people around you, hopefully. You, especially when they're doing kind of interval starts, it's very difficult to know who you're racing and who's in your age group and in this, that and the other. So I always try to direct athletes to swim with other people if they're comfortable swimming with other people, because I think it helps pace and I think it helps relaxation. And you're not going to win an age group triathlon on the swim unless you're an incredible swimmer. So stick in your comfort zones. And then on the bike, I always set power or RPE for the first 30 minutes and then forget about it and stick with RPE, because I don't want them looking at a power meter. But it would be, it's good to kind of calibrate at the beginning so that you don't go crazy. Have a nutrition plan. So both pros and age groupers, I would say, always have a nutrition plan in terms of when you're going to take calories in and where you're going to get them from. That's something that I got better at in my long distance career, and it did heavily influence my results. And then on the run, it's about, for age groupers, it's about pace management, I think. So you're always trying to come back at the end of the race faster than that which you started. And that's an individual plan, so don't get carried away with other people. That would be my direction to age group athletes.
Yeah. How do you get an idea or an estimate of what an age grouper might be able to do in terms of pacing on the run if they ask you, what do you think I can run for this half distance or for this full Ironman?
Yeah, so I'll analyse the sessions that I've set and what they manage to maintain. Often with age groupers, it's less obvious than I see more variation in age groupers than professional athletes in terms of turning it on the day. The professional athletes often have the sessions behind them and you can see that pace on race day. But occasionally, with my age groupers, their race pace is absolutely far above anything that they've demonstrated in training. But because they don't have the stress of life around them and they're rested and it's a race. So I can get a fair idea in terms of pacing for the bike, in terms of power, in terms of the MP that you would look for the majority of the ride. And I'm usually quite accurate with that at the end of the race. But in terms of running, I think they dictate how hard. So I say, okay, you've got to run 21.1K. So don't start off harder than 7 out of 10 RPE. And then as you loosen off, as you feel differently, then you make that call. And they're experienced athletes in the majority, and they definitely are not as fit as professional athletes, and there might be some more slowing down, but they usually do a really good job at it.
Yeah, no, that's really good. I definitely think that's one thing that plays a big role. If you take a few days off before a race, then you'll have such a greater chance of being able to really perform on race day, because the stress of work and everything is not really there the same way that it normally is in normal training week. So definitely a good point there. Now, just a few other questions around the training. So what's your thought on strength and conditioning within a triathlon training program?
I definitely think strength and conditioning is an area to be explored, particularly by professional athletes that have a lot of load and volume. So the strength and conditioning, I've seen some really complex strength and conditioning programs, both prescribed to me and prescribed to my athletes. And I've seen some really simple ones too. And I see no direct correlation as to how much time you spend on strength and conditioning as to the, you get less injuries. I think that there's probably a couple of hours a week is enough. And I think going over and above that, there's not too much benefit of that. So I think if it's considered and it's not particularly progressional, because some of the problems that I have with strength and conditioning coaching is that it's not well executed in terms of its progression training. The principles of training are that it's progressional, so any coach likes to progress their sessions, but actually once you've hit the threshold of enough strength for to stop you getting injured for running or cycling or swimming, then I think it becomes actually a negative thing that takes energy away from other types of training. So when I see a strength and conditioning program that is getting harder and harder and harder every week to maintain, it kind of sets alarm bells to me. If it's a steady state, constant maintenance, I think it's a great thing in a program. And actually, for age group athletes, as much as they can do it as well, because again, their time is limited and it's an aerobic sport, you would be employing a strength and conditioning program that would enable you to perform an aerobic program without getting injured. That would be the role of it for me.
And are you, do you think that you can get most of your strength and conditioning done at home using just a few simple tools, or do you like your athletes to do some work in the gym, or what's your thought on that?
Yes, I do. I do think you can do it at home. However, I think if you're used to having people showing you what to do and you find that easier, that's a good thing. If you find the right person, that's a good thing to do too, to get a strength and conditioning coach to help you, even if just occasionally to check your form, etc., and to kind of tick the box that you're actually doing it. I think that's also useful. But if you're self-motivated to do it, if you don't hate it, which quite a number of my athletes are quite averse to doing strength and conditioning training, I think if you can do it yourself, I think it's an absolute, it just saves time. You dictate it yourself, and you can do it when you're not so tired in terms of stability, etc. So yeah, that would be the ideal plan, but lots of people don't have the drive to do it. So it would be best to employ someone to help you then.
Yeah, yeah. What about nutrition? First of all, I can ask you, how do you work? What questions do your athletes have of you, or how do you help your athletes with nutrition? Because at the end of the day, like, we're triathlon coaches, but there's also nutrition plays a big part in how athletes perform in training and in racing. So what are the things that you, how do you help your athletes with nutrition?
So I definitely help them in terms of setting out a nutrition plan for training and racing. That's simple. That's you taking this many carbs. In terms of training, please eat something directly after training. If it's a hard session, even if it's a glass of milk, I want you to do that. That's the first thing that I'm going to tell you to do. That sort of basic nutritional guidelines is something that I would employ for everyone. But then there's the other aspect of nutrition in terms of some, and I speak from a personal point of view here, a lot of my athletic career was influenced by poor nutrition. I had an eating disorder for a start, and many female athletes in particular have issues around eating and inconsistent eating and dieting and trying to limit body weight. For obvious reasons, but actually because they may carry societal things as well. They just have issues. It might be the reason why they got into the sport, or it might be the reason why they want to train more, et cetera, et cetera. So I like to create really honest atmospheres with all my athletes, but particularly the female ones, around eating and about eating disorders and about things that you actually think and aren't going to tell anyone. Tell me what you think. And then I can try and see through those conversations, I can try and see where someone's coming from my unfortunately massive experience with eating problems, that I can try and address. And I would address that problem as much as I can when I see it rearing up in the training feedback, because it's massive into our sport, and it's something that not that many people kind of, I think because we don't have as many female coaches, perhaps, I think it's kind of something we push aside. But it's massive. I mean, if you listen to the Norwegian coaches and sports scientists, intake of nutrition is kind of the fundamental thing that they're attributing their success to, right? And how much calories their athletes can burn. And this is huge. And I think if you're doing it wrong, as I did my whole career and still succeeding, then imagine what you can do if you do it right. That's the way I would approach it. And yeah, I I think that certainly with the athletes that I'm working with, we're coming into a really good area in terms of how we differentiate between weight and how we differentiate between performance and training. And I think that distinction is a helpful one.
Yeah. I asked you earlier about what are there some early changes that you make in athletes programs, like trends that you see. And for me, if I were to answer that question, it definitely is that making sure that they fuel more than they have been before, because even athletes that do fuel their workouts and eat well, will make sure that their energy needs are met first of all, but also making sure that the timing is good in terms of getting something in right after your workouts, as you mentioned. Even when athletes kind of tick the boxes, there's usually quite a lot of improvements they can do by just fueling even more instead of getting in a couple of gels per hour when you have a long bike ride.
Yeah.
Go up to 90 grams per hour and you'll find that you perform better, and you perform better the next day in particular when you... So for me, that's a very easy win to get early on with an athlete.
Yeah.
To try to encourage more fueling.
And actually, a lot of it doesn't stem from eating problems or being scared of calories. It actually stems from being completely disorganized and not really thinking about it because they've got hectic lifestyles. So yeah, that's an easy one.
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, there are trends, the whole fasted training trend and low-carb training trend, they have been kind of ongoing, and part of that stems from scientific research and just studies that came, and then people jumped on it even when there maybe wasn't anything in terms of performance benefits proven, but people do like to see exciting new things and try new things, but I think that also contributed to some issues that we already have in endurance sports in general, in terms of weight being a massive determining factor and of performance, which quite often athletes might actually be too low a body weight for them to perform optimally.
Yeah, and I think that people, when they see new pieces of research or something that someone else is doing, you know, a low carb diet, et cetera, and it's working, I think then sometimes they'll jump on that bandwagon or that train of thought when they actually don't have all the information about what that athlete might be doing at other times, or why this research isn't actually relevant to exactly you. So it's really quite dangerous to have a tiny bit of knowledge and not all the knowledge. I'd rather an athlete in some ways had less knowledge, but was all encompassing when they wanted to find something out. But yeah, it's difficult because everyone's looking for clues, aren't they? And a quick clue is faster speed, and it, you know, it's difficult to manage sometimes. But yeah, it's possible with just clear guidelines and just detecting it early, I think.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned there also how it might relate to there being few female coaches in triathlon, and I think that's true in endurance sports in general. Can you talk about that? First of all, why do you think that is? And secondly, what can be done to change that?
When I was new to coaching, I didn't really consider it. I just thought that maybe women didn't really want to get into it. But having encountered a few issues in my coaching from being a woman, or not actually issues, but feelings and atmospheres, and so sort of suddenly looking around poolside and realizing that you are the only female and you think about things slightly different to other people, I think that probably is a systemic problem with coaching in any sport, that there are less females that both compete and coach. So it's kind of like a symbiotic relationship. One of the problems that I've had in coaching is that they've asked for quite a lot of, so I want to coach development athletes in time. And to do that, they've asked for quite a lot of volunteering time to coach, which would be absolutely fine if I didn't have kids. And I take on the role as a mother, because my husband works full time. So I think that there's those logistical issues with coaching, But then there's also the atmosphere. So if women have taken time out for maternity leave or have taken time out of the sport or and then are coming back to it, I think that sometimes the coaching circles become quite closed and they sort of stick within their own pool of knowledge. So someone new coming in with different perspectives or maybe different ways they approach things or just generally just being a woman is not that welcoming. So you turn yourself to something else that is welcoming, I think. I don't think it's all atmospheres, and there's certainly some amazing female coaches that I've had, but it has been in the latter period of my career, and that might be because it's getting better, I think.
Mm. Do you think there's a difference between long distance triathlon and short distance triathlon? Because long distance is less influenced by the politics of federations and so on, but you still see very few female coaches there. So even if that is an issue, then there's something else that causes that discrepancy something is an issue that holds back the number of female coaches simply participating in triathlon.
I absolutely think that there is a difference between coaching as a self-employed coach as to a federation coach. Yes, definitely. There's definitely a factor that males dominate that arena in most federations. So either you're a pioneer woman and you want to take that position or you just get on with your own thing. So that's definitely a thing in federation-based coaching. In terms of personal coaching, I think the influence of family so elite athletes often want to coach after their careers, but they take time out to have kids and look after the kids. And I think that the imposter syndrome is a real thing when you come back. Especially with women. And I don't know why that is particularly with women, but I expect that it's because you're coming back to a masculine-based arena and therefore you feel a bit awkward anyway. It's not something that you really can really understand until you experience it yourself. And so it's the only time I've spoken about it is now, because I think you can, as a woman, you can succeed in whatever you want to do, and you can push it and you can make sure that it works. But less people are going to do it if it's really hard, I think. And then you get this kind of snowball effect where it just looks like women aren't interested in coaching, whereas women actually bring something very different to coaching quite a lot of the time. And just because it isn't kind of acknowledged by the male arena, it doesn't mean that it's not significant. You look at people like Siri Linley and Julie Dibbons, they're absolute pioneers of women coaching and have had real true success with both men and female athletes. So there's absolutely nothing to say that a female coach can't bring just as much in different ways to a male.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And do you have any thoughts on, are there any sort of immediate steps or near or midterm future things that could be done to improve the situation?
I'm not really. I don't think so. I think that there are guidelines in terms of how many female employees should be in a federation as opposed to the males, but I'm not sure if that's across the board in terms of every country. And that would be a good start, because I think if you're getting people trained up in federation-based arenas, then those people can then teach in federation-based arenas, and then they become qualified coaches if that's what you're looking for. I've recently done a British Triathlon qualification course, and there were lots of females there. But interestingly enough, it was on the internet because of COVID, and they spoke less. So, yeah, I think that there's this just general societal thing that sport is a male-dominated arena. Even in triathlon, where you know, we're in this unique position where women are absolutely truly rallied in the sport in terms of the competition, in terms of prize money, in terms of sponsorship, but it just hasn't filtered through just yet. And we are a new sport, and I think it's just going to take time and a bit of attention to see that it is becoming an issue.
Yeah. Do you think that there's I hear in Portugal, when you go to a race, like a race that federation puts up, a sprint or Olympic distance race, there's probably 75% to 80% of the participants that are boys or male across the kind of adult and junior and children's ranks, youth ranks. So here I definitely see that there is a, even from the very early age where people first get into the sport and as participants, there is a big difference. And that I can see that filtering through to also then later coaching, of course. But I don't know, I expect that in the UK, the discrepancy there is less in terms of participation, at least, than it's here, perhaps. But do you think that can have a play a role?
Yeah, definitely. I think I saw a figure recently that 85% of girls drop out of sport in their late teenage years, drop out of competitive sport in their late teenage years. And that's a societal problem across all sports. And there's many reasons why. It might be because they feel uncomfortable training alongside boys, that changes in physicality, they don't understand the menstrual cycle and how it influences training, and they just can't be bothered with it. There's so many things that could influence that and can't as easily be addressed by a male coach as a female, and then therefore you get the feedback loop. Because if there was a female coach helping with that, then that would stop the dropout early on in school, and that dropout would be less, and therefore there would be more people that would go on to endurance sport as a way of life. So it's not just triathlon. It's definitely the way we educate girls in sport, and there are initiatives to try and change that. But it's going to take time, and it's going to take male coaches to embrace it too.
Yeah. I have one final question before the rapid fire question, and that's what's one thing within coaching or triathlon that you're currently learning about or fascinated by, and why?
So much, because there's just so much development and just, lots of discussion. I'm quite fascinated by the Norwegian program. I'm quite fascinated about the girls' role in that, why we see the predominant men succeeding and not the females in that program, and where it's going to go from now, and how it's influenced absolutely every other federation in the world, and how that plays out. I'm quite fascinated in that.
Yeah, no, that's a good one, and I totally agree with you there. Let's get into the rapid fire questions. So take one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to triathlon?
Don't really read that many, because I didn't read that many as an athlete, because I tried to limit my views. But I was told to buy Healthy Intelligent Training by a coach called Chris Jones in my younger years. It sort of explains the Lydiard methods of training, which actually aren't that displaced from some of the current fads of training. I like to look back at stuff like that and remind myself of other people's principles of training.
Yeah. And what's an important habit that you've benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Athletically, personally, definitely is perseverance. That there's always setbacks, but if you persevere, you'll get there in the end or get near there in the end, and that's the most important thing.
And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
It's hard for me to have idols, because most of the people in triathlon I know too well to kind of idolize. But there's many people in women, particularly in triathlon that I looked up to and just think what they do is amazing. I think Flora Duffy, I will as a friend, I will, or Nicola Spirig, either one of them, amazing women.
Yeah. Those are both great calls. I think Nicola Spirig, with her having three kids, is something absolutely extraordinary.
But I think with Nicola Spirig, it's more that she's just a really nice person as well. She's an incredible athlete and with lots going on, but she'll still answer a kind text message on your birthday. That those sort of things, that she's kept the absolute niceness about her character.
Yeah. Great. And finally, where can people follow you? Are you active on social media, websites and so on?
Not really. Not that active on social media with time limitations, but I am on Instagram at Jodie Swallow Coaching. They can get in contact with me there if they want to do that or follow my hectic life win pictures.
Yeah, and I'll put the link to that and to your website as well. You have your coaching website, so I'll put that in the show notes for listeners.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jodie. It's been great to talk to you. Thank you for all the information you shared, and look forward to talking another time.
Thank you.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. In the show notes and the episode description on your podcast app, as always, you can find links to Jodie's website and her Instagram. Next week's guest on the podcast is Dr. Andy King, and we will talk about the science of hydrogels in endurance sports. So hydrogels includes products such as Morton and SIS Beta Fuel, which have become really popular in recent years. And we will talk about how they work, do they work, are they worth it, and so on. If you want to improve your triathlon performance and want help to achieve your goals, then consider working with a scientific triathlon coach or training plan. Whether you're just getting into triathlon or you're trying to qualify for a world championship event or even want to race professionally, we have experience in all of those scenarios and would love to discuss further around if and how we can help you on your triathlon journey. Find out more and contact us on scientifictriathlon.com, and we can discuss your specific goals and needs and see what's best for you. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free online sweat test and quick carb calculator to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs and individualize your plan. And book a free video consultation with the team to refine your strategy. Use the code TTS22 at checkout for 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, and exceptional sunglasses and prescription glasses for everything from day-to-day wear to extreme action sports. Use the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS to get 20% off your entire Roka order. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.